Hi, Tape Man. You got it. I'm Frank Jones. I'm an alcoholic. And we still got folks coming. I just want to tell any of you that just got here that for the next AA meeting, which is tonight, and Jim's talking, it'll be all right if you get there on time. It ain't against the law. I don't judge. I just learned in Alcoholics Anonymous it's just okay to get there on time. I try to do that. Of course, I understand you got to get popcorn and Cokes and everything, so that's okay, too. I'm not a member of the Saturday Night Live group. We're not in a tent yet, so let's keep the noise down, clowns. I was kidding. Doggone it. It's good to be here. I want to thank my friend Jim for asking me to participate here in the committee for allowing me to share at this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's just good to be in San Jose and be a part of this. And I'm honored to be on the same speaker's guest list that Ted is and that Jim is. And Diane yesterday gave a great talk. And tomorrow, Linda. And it's just nice to be here. And I'm comfortable with that. And the only thing I can tell you is that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And if it didn't work, I wouldn't be here. Because I'm into comfort. I'm not into pain anymore. I don't get motivated by pain. Pain don't motivate me at all. You see, I can stand a lot of pain, and I could stand a lot of pain before I got here. And so I'm usually really in deep crap before pain ever affects me. So I gauge my sobriety by my comfort, and so I like to be comfortable. And if AA wasn't doing it for me, I wouldn't be here. So if you're new today, that's the only thing I can tell you. Was it Alcoholics Anonymous works, or I wouldn't be here. And it's just good. The other thing I got to tell you is, you're not going to hear anything but Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm just a drunk. I don't go to ACA meetings. I don't go to CODA. I don't go to Affected Member Family Syndrome meetings. I don't go to NASA, Sex Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, or any other damn anonymous. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor set me straight on that right off the bat by advising me that if I couldn't work the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, I damn sure couldn't work any other 12 steps, so, because they all come from us. We're the original. So if I can't work ours, I can't work the others. And the other thing is I can't blame nobody for my problem. I can't blame my mom and dad. I can't blame my wives. I can't blame my jobs. I can't blame anything except the person that's standing here in the middle of my wardrobe. I'm my biggest problem, and I didn't know that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's just what you're going to hear tonight. The only thing that I can tell you also is that I have no reason to be an alcoholic, for Christ's sakes. I mean, look at me. I mean, I don't look like an alcoholic. Ted looks like an alcoholic. You know, Jesus, I can tell that. But I don't even look like an alcoholic. You folks here in San Jose do. Saturday Night Live folks look like alcoholics. Not a problem. I come from a good home. I was born in Danville, Illinois. And you got it. I love it. Way to go, Bruce. You think I don't know him? Well, I met him before the meeting. I didn't hide in my room. I've been out meeting and greeting. I've been taught that here in AA. But I was born in Danville, Illinois, and I had ideal parents. My parents were phenomenal. Mom and dad were married 50 years. My dad worked the same job for 40. And he was a kind man, he was a loving man, and he was not an alcoholic. My mom was home for us. She was there. And I had an ideal childhood. If I had wrote out a script for my childhood, I couldn't have written it out any better than it was. You see, I was blessed with some athletic ability, and I liked to play sports. And I played football, basketball, and I run track, and I played Little League and Pony League baseball. So I just had an ideal childhood, and I didn't think I had any problems. And then I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you folks screwed that up for me. As soon as I did my fourth and fifth step and I looked back over some of my character defects and shortcomings, I realized that I started those at an early age. You see, I found out when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a liar and a cheat and a thief growing up. And I didn't plan to be a liar and a cheat and a thief. It just happened that way. It was just easier. And I've looked for the easier, softer way all my life. And it was just easier to steal stuff than it was to work and pay for it. It was just easier to cheat and lie than it was to be honest. And so I had to just do that. And so that's what I grew up with. And I know you can't tell right now, but I also grew up with a problem of perfectionism. And I know you can't see that, but I did. And I tell you, it got so bad that Mom and Dad would go grocery shopping or something, and I'd wash and wax the kitchen floor, I'd polish furniture, I'd wash the windows or something, just to feel a part of. And Dad or Mom would put a cigarette out in the ashtray, and I'd go clean it and wipe it off. And even today, I could spot dust on the floor at 50 feet. I could just... And I used to walk around the house, and when we moved into a house, And I used to say, what's all the lint doing on the carpet? Now, my wife's an Al-Anon. You know what she'd say? Why are you always looking down? Well, hell, I don't have an answer for something like that. I'm slow. And I'd have to call my sponsor, and so he'd give me the answer that I started looking up. And so then I started spotting cobwebs in the corners. No problem. But I was a perfectionist growing up, and that's how I was, and my parents didn't put those demands on me. That's just how Frank Jones was. And the other thing was, growing up, we had a little girl lived next door to us, and she was my age, and her and I started playing doctor at an early age. And we... That's not funny. That was serious. We loved it, dear. Her and I started comparing the differences between her and I liked the differences. And, you know, I was taught right from wrong. I was taught right... If you're an AA also, that don't change. You're going to keep liking the difference, so don't let that bother you. When you get sober, it ain't boring. But her and I, we used to try to play doctor and stuff, and I felt guilty about that because I was raised in a good home, and I knew the things that her and I were doing was wrong. But I used to stuff that guilt down because if it felt good, I just kept doing it. And, you know, if it felt really good, I overdid it, and that's why I wear glasses today, for Christ's sake. So, you know... And then the other thing, when I was growing up back there in Denver, Illinois, what I wanted to do, and I don't know about you guys, but all my life I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be a part of something. I wanted to be a part of you guys. I wanted to fit in with you as a crowd that got together in school, and they talked before school, and they went out and did things together, and they was always together and stuff. And, you know, I wanted to be a part of that, and I never felt a part of that growing up. And looking back in sobriety, I was a big part of all that, because, you see, I won 9 letters in high school, and I had scholarship offers to go to college and play ball, and so I was a part of, but I didn't feel a part of, because, you see, when I got with you guys, I had secrets that I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you that I was a liar and a cheat and a thief because you wouldn't like me. The other thing was, when I grew up during the era when John Wayne and Wild Bill Hickok and Lash LaRue and these macho guys were on the silver screen, and I wanted to be macho. I wanted to fit in with you guys because you guys look cool, you guys look tough, and I wanted to be macho. I wanted to feel like a man, for Christ. Look at me. I mean, I look like Mr. Peepers. That dude ain't macho. There's no way that Mr. Peepers is macho, so I felt like a wimp. And then I had the secret that I couldn't tell you guys that I played ball with. I'm afraid of the dark. I couldn't tell nobody how afraid I was. I couldn't tell you that I was afraid of the dark because I was ashamed of that. And I had to push that fear and those feelings down inside me. I had to suck it up, and I had to put a facade out there for you. I had to put an unreal me out there for you. And that's how I acted. And then when I got through with ball practice, I'd go down on Main Street. Now, in Danville, Illinois, on Main Street, is where the real macho... You dudes from San Jose here would have fit down on Main Street, okay? These are the tough guys. I mean, these are the guys when I was growing up now, okay? I'm a little bit old. They had ducktail haircuts, DA haircuts, long sideburns. These guys wore black leather jackets with the zippers and doodads on them when it meant something. These guys wore engineer boots. They wore Levi's, and they carried something you probably never heard of, and that's called zip guns. And they carried switchblade knives, and these were bad dudes. But you see, I wanted to fit in with those guys so bad. And I went down there, and these guys scared me. And when they scared me and they got too close to me, I had no choice but to fight. And hell, I'm too light to fight and too thin to win. So I had to come up with the technique of ambush. And so I did that. And I'd pick up clubs and bricks and sticks and hit these guys with. Because they scared me so bad. And when you scared me, I had to use violence to keep you away from me. And I didn't want you to know how I felt inside. And I'd hit these guys, and I'd run home, and then at home I'd think, God, I hit him with that brick, and I shouldn't have. I felt bad. And, you know, when I seen the tough guys on the silver screen, and I seen you guys fight, you never looked like you felt bad when you hurt somebody. And I felt bad, and I couldn't tell you about it, so I'd stuff those feelings down. Macho guys don't feel sorry for somebody they hit in the face, and I just had to feel macho. And what happened, that's the feelings and emotions I grew up with. Everything I did, I had a feeling about, and I stuffed them because I didn't know how to react to them. I was too immature, and I didn't know that. And I hadn't even had a drink yet. And what happened was, I was at a party one night back there in Danville, and it was a hot summer night, and I was with my girlfriend, and her and I used to play doctor, for Christ's sakes. And her parents used to tell her, don't hang out with me, that I was a bad kid. Can you believe that? I'm just a nice guy raised in the Midwest. But this broad brought me up a 16-ounce tea glass full of Slow Gin and 7-Up. And I'd never drank Slow Gin or 7-Up before together. And what happened was, I took a drink of that, and it tastes like strawberry Kool-Aid. And I couldn't believe it. I love strawberry Kool-Aid. And so I chugged that whole 16-ounce tea glass down, the Slow Gin and 7-Up. And you hear a lot of speakers stand up here, and they'll tell you that they drank that first drink, and it went down inside their stomach, and it moved around in there, and they got all warm and fuzzy. And that their pimples fell off, and they got 6'4" and gained 240 pounds. That crap didn't happen to me. I drank that glass of Slow Gin and 7-Up, and nothing happened. Not a damn thing happened. I didn't get a bottle of wine, put it in a paper bag, put on a trench coat, and go hang out on Skid Row. That didn't happen to me. What I did was I handed her that glass back, and I said, go get me another one. And she did. And I was going to boss women around from then on until my wife found out, and I ruined that. Now I don't boss anybody around, except the guys I sponsor. I kind of boss them around a tad. I give them direction. That's what I do. I forgot. Sponsorship talk this morning. Direction's what I give them. And I told her to get me another one, and they brought that back to me, and I drank that one down, and nothing happened. I didn't cross some invisible line. I didn't get the shakes. I didn't grow hair on the palms of my hand. I didn't think, hey, you're going to speak in San Jose. You better remember the effects of this stuff. I didn't remember it. I just drank the crap down, and I drank about a gallon of it in about 20 minutes, and nothing happened. Nothing happened. And about 30 minutes after that last glass, I found out where slow gin got its name. Hell, I got drunk, and I don't know how that happened. And what happened was I went into a blackout, and I didn't remember it. It's a blackout, for Christ's sake. So, if you say, hey, I never had blackouts, or at least any that I remember, you're not going to remember them. And what happened is I got taken home by my buddies that night, and I passed out. And the next morning, I come to, and I don't know what kind of hangovers you had when you were 17, but I couldn't open my eyes because the light hurt my eyes. And every time Mom yelled at me, my body vibrated and it hurt. And I was throwing this red stuff up all over the bedroom. And as I walked down the hall trying to hold it, it was just oozing out. And I was vomiting this stuff up, and I couldn't remember what had happened the night before. And I missed 3 days of school with a hangover. And I was sicker than hell. And I couldn't remember what had happened. And I went to school, and I got with the guys, and they started telling me what happened. And, you know, I liked the recognition I got. But the other thing is I thought, how did they remember that? Because, you see, what I thought was that those guys that I was drinking with drank the same way I did. I thought that when they drank, they experienced what I did. I thought that they couldn't remember either. And I thought that's how everybody drank that night. And they told me that I was dancing and I was funny. And they said this guy lipped off and that I hit him and he went through the screen door. And, you know, I didn't remember any of that, but I liked the recognition. And I felt macho and I felt like a man and I couldn't remember that. And, you know, I didn't know until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out from you folks what a blackout was. And I don't know if you ever had a blackout. But I found out when I got to AA that a blackout was when Frank Jones consumed amounts of alcohol. I'd continue to function and do the things I'm doing. And then the next morning, I'd wake up or I'd come to and I wouldn't remember where in the hell I'd been. You ever have that happen? Or you can't remember where you parked your car. Or you can do one of these. You look over and there's something laying there. And you don't know what in the hell this thing is. And it's been marked and tagged by animal control. Now, the women don't need to laugh because look at what you're sitting next to, for Christ's sake. You know, you didn't have the winners with you. And, that was a blackout. And I didn't know that that was an indication that I might have a problem drinking. I didn't know that that was a problem that I might have a problem with alcohol. I never filed that away or nothing. I thought those guys had the same thing. And what I did was I kept getting in fights in school. And the bigger you get, the fights get worse. And I started hurting some guys. And I started to get in a lot of trouble. And then I had scholarship offers. And I can't go to college. And I'm starting to drink beer with the guys on the football team. And then I had secrets. And you guys knew what you wanted to be when you were going to grow up. And you knew what you were going to major in and everything. And I didn't know. And I couldn't tell you. I didn't know what the word vocation meant. Because I was ashamed of that. And I couldn't tell you, so how can I go to college when I don't know what vocation I'm going into? And so I did what macho tough guys do when they don't know what they're going to be when they grow up and they're not going to go to college. And I turned down a scholarship, and I quit high school, and I joined the Marine Corps because that's macho. And, I found myself on a train going up to Chicago, and I'm sitting on that train next to my idol. And this guy, God, I want to fit in with this guy. I don't know if when you drank and you were out in public and stuff, you wanted to fit in with guys. But I looked at this guy, and I thought, God, this guy's cool. I'm sitting there like Mr. Peepers. I got on my cheaters, and I got on my white turtleneck sweater, and I got on my leather jacket, my little chino pants with the buckle in the back, and I'm cool, and I got a flat top. And this dude's sitting there in a black leather jacket. He's got a greasy ducktail haircut, long sideburns, oily engineer boots, dirty Levi's, and he's drinking stuff out of a little brown bottle. And I think, Jesus, look at this guy. He's something, ain't he? And this guy says, hey, man, you want to hit off of this, and what am I going to tell this guy I want to fit in with? No. I said, sure I do. And he gave me that bottle. And I thought, slow gin and 7-Up and beer. So I took it and drank it just like I did that. And I took 3 or 4 big mouthfuls and I swallowed it down. And I don't know how you drank whiskey when you was 7-Up, when you was 17. But I can only tell you how I drank whiskey. When I took that last drink, it hit the bottom of my stomach and I threw that crap back up all over the seats in front of me. And I got tears coming out of my eyes and I got snot running out of my nose and I don't look macho. And I feel like a wimp. And I feel like a wussy, but I want to fit in with this guy, and I want him to like me. So I wipe off my face, and I hand him that bottle back, and I said, boy, that was good. I just wanted to be liked. I just wanted to fit in with somebody, and I wanted to be a part of all my life. And he says, you want another drink? And I said, no, not right now. Hell, I could hardly talk, for Christ's sakes. And, you know, out of those drinking experiences that I had, I can tell you that from that day back then and the day I drank slow gin and 7-Up, the only thing that made sense to me was I didn't drink 7-Up anymore when I drank. I drank straight whiskey or beer because that stuff didn't make me crazy and make me do the things I did. And so he says, you want some more? And I didn't drink anymore, but I went to Chicago and I got sworn in and I flew out to California and I found myself at MCRD San Diego. And I'm macho now. I'm a big macho dude. I'm out here with these older guys. They're all 19, 20-year-old, and I'm on the bus with them. And this guy gets on the bus down at MCRD San Diego, and he's got a shaved head. And he's got a funny round hat on. And I don't know how he picks me out of all those people on that bus, but he snatches me up, and he throws me off that bus, and he calls me dirty names. You people here in AA don't even use. And I felt inadequate, and I felt like a wimp, and I felt frightened, and I couldn't tell anybody. And so I pushed those feelings down inside me. And I got through boot camp full of fear and full of homesickness and full of anxiety and things that I couldn't discuss with anybody. And I didn't have alcohol to take those things away. And I got out of boot camp and I ended up at Camp Pendleton. And in October of 62, I found myself on a ship going through the Panama Canal. And I'm going to get to go kill Cubans. And I think that's dynamite. And I'm macho and I like that. And I'm afraid. And I can't tell the Marines I'm with how frightened I am. And I'm sitting around my bunk sharpening my bayonet because I've seen John Wayne do that in the sands of Iwo Jima. And some of my buddies broke in the narcotics locker on that ship, and they went up and they come down and they brought me a morphine syrette down. And they handed me that morphine syrette, and I took the plastic cap off, and I stuck that needle in my leg, and I squeezed that juice out, and then I wasn't afraid anymore, and I went up on the deck of the ship, and I laid out there all night looking at the stars. And if you'd have walked up to me that night and said, Frank, you know why you're not afraid no more? It's that morphine you put in your system. I'd have told you you're crazy. That morphine ain't got anything to do with this. I grew up all of a sudden. I matured. That's why. And I didn't know back then in 1962 what morphine or a narcotic could do for me. I didn't know that taking that narcotic, putting it into my system, would take that fear away I was feeling, would take that anxiety away that I was feeling, the terror that Ted talked about last night, that morphine and narcotic took that away and allowed me to put up the facade I thought you guys would accept so I could be a part of you. I didn't know that it did that. Now, the other thing I got to tell you is I didn't use any more dope. So you're not going to hear any dope stories tonight. I got to tell you this. I don't think it really takes any talent to be a dope fiend. I hate to break your heart. All you got to do is just take a syringe, fill it up with narcotic, stick that dude into your vein, squeeze it in, and you're going to become addicted. I don't know any social heroin users. What can I tell you? And if you're going to be an alcoholic, you can't just drink one beer and come to AA. It just don't work that way. You got to be able to do some things if you're going to be an alcoholic. You know, you got to hang in. You got to be able to drink a lot of booze. You got to be able to go to bed and wet the bed. You got to be able to wet your pants. You got to be able to crap your pants. You got to be able to go to jail and nut house it. You got to be able to sleep in the bushes and abuse your families and everything. And you got to do it one day at a time for years. You just got to work at this deal. You can't just get it. So what happened was, is I knew I had to be in San Jose tonight, so I didn't take any more drugs. I just drank. And what happened was I didn't get to kill any Cubans, and I was disappointed. And so I ended up in the Far East in Okinawa, and the first night there, the guy says, let's go get drunk. And I said, let's go. You notice that I didn't say, let's go out and have a beer or two, and then I'm going to go write letters to Mom and Dad. I was an alcoholic from the jump. I went out to get drunk with these guys, and what we did was we bought a Typhoon Fifth of sake, and it held about 2 gallons. And that cost us 75 cents back then. And we were standing there in a little group, about 6 of us, and they started passing that bottle around. And that bottle got to me, and it looked like water. And I took 4 or 5 big mouthfuls of that sake. And I don't know how you drank sake when you were 17. I can only tell you how I drank sake when I was 17. I took that last drink, and it only had one place to go. I threw that crap back up. And I had tears running out of my eyes. Had snot running down my nose, and I didn't look macho. I looked like a wimp, and that's what I tell you. If you're going to be an alcoholic, you got to hang in. You can't let looking bad bother you. And I hung in with it. And I hung in with it, and I drank some more, and I threw that up, and I drank some more and threw that up. And I just was looking bad, and these guys were poking each other and laughing at me, and I finally held enough of that stuff down. And something happened, and I remember it. What happened was, I drank some of that sake, and it stayed down inside me, and I looked at those other 5 guys I was standing there with, and I realized something. I realized that those guys were all punks, and I didn't need them. They were holding me back. And what alcohol did was tell me that I could go out and conquer the world on my own. And that I was too cool to be with these guys. So I split. And I went out on my own. And I spent my whole paycheck on wine, women, and song. And what happened was I started drinking some Akadama wine and some Suntory whiskey and shot some pool, and a Marine from another unit leapt off, and I hit him with a pool cue in the face, and I felt bad about that. And so I drank whiskey, and it took that feeling bad away, and then I got me a Nissan. And then her and I went to her little hooch, and I gave her some money, and we did what we had to do. And she went to clean up, so I stole my money back and set her hooch on fire. Hell, I thought that was macho. And I went back to the base, and I passed out. And the next morning, I come to, and I just had a horrendous hangover. And I started thinking about the things I'd done, and I couldn't remember. Some of the guys come up and started telling me. They told me about the Marine I hit with the pool cue, and I felt bad about that. And the guilt just ate me up, because I didn't want to do that to anybody, and I didn't remember doing it. And then they told me about that Nissan, and that I took her money and I set her hooch on fire, and I didn't even know if she'd got out of there. And I felt guilt about that, and I felt shame. And then I opened up my locker, and there's a bottle with a big red dot on it. It's Akadama wine, and I found out a secret over at the age of 17. And I found out when I took that bottle down and I took three or four big drinks off that wine in the morning, you know what happened? That guilt I felt about hitting that Marine, that went away. I didn't care. I could have cared less about it. And that Nissan that I set her hooch on fire and stole my money back, I didn't care about her no more. And I started bragging about it. And you know the headache I had and the upset stomach? It went away. And what happened to Frank Jones was that he became a morning drinker and a daily drinker at the age of 17 over. Because there wasn't any drinking age. Because, you see, alcohol worked for me. Alcohol took away the feelings that I couldn't deal with and allowed me to act the way I thought that you wanted me to act to be accepted. And I went on a tear over. The Marine Corps frowns on my actions. And what happened was the more I fought, the more trouble I got into. And then the more trouble I got into, the more I had to drink. And if you'd have come up and told me that drinking was my problem, I'd have told you you're crazy. Drinking ain't got anything to do with this. It's the CO, or it's those little rice-propelled dudes over there. They're overcharging me for drinks, and they're doing this, and they're doing that, and all I can do is point the finger at everybody. It was never Frank Jones that was a problem. It was never alcohol. It was always you, and it was always them, and it was always a situation. And I blamed everybody. I never looked at me as being the problem until I got to AA. I could always point the finger that it was other things. It was the wife, or it was the kids, or if they didn't act that way, or they didn't do that to me. And finally, I run out of money over one day, and I needed money to drink on now, and so me and my buddy decided to rob a cab driver, and we hailed the cab down, and we jerked him out and held his head down on the pavement, and I picked up the rock the size of a softball, and I beat his face in with it that day. And what happened was the Marine Corps really frowns on that. That was during Kennedy's people-to-people program. And what happened was I had a general court-martial, and my father flew to Okinawa, and he paid for that man's reconstructive surgery, and he paid for his medical bills and his retirement, and I begged the Marine Corps not to throw me out. And if you had told me that drinking played a part in that, I would have told you you're crazy. The only reason we were doing that is because those guys overcharged us. They put the meter on too soon. And, you know, I had rationalizations and justifications for why I was in the trouble I was in. And it wasn't me. And what happened was I got sentenced to 2 years confinement in the federal penitentiary and back to duty. Now, if you spend more than 6 months locked up, you can't do that. And so what happened was they started processing my paperwork to get me out of the slammer. And by the time they did it, I had spent a year locked up. And what happened was I was at Camp Pendleton now, and I met a woman and I married her. And you know, when I got married, she started running her mouth. And then when she ran her mouth, I got to react to those things. And I got to become abusive. And I got to become angry. And I got to become hostile. And then I got to leave the house. And then I feel guilty about leaving that dizzy broad at home. And then I got to drink whiskey to take the guilt away. And then somebody will say something to me in the bar, and I got to hit him with an ashtray. And then I feel bad about that. And so I got to drink some more to take these feelings away. And then I got to meet a woman, and I got to go home with her because I need somebody to tell me I'm okay. Because, you see, I don't feel okay. Because I feel like trash inside because of what I did to her and how I treated her. And then this woman's telling me I'm okay, and she's telling me that it'll be all right, and I'm a good guy, and her and I do what we have to do. And then I think, God, that wife at home didn't deserve this. She didn't do anything to cause this. And then I got to drink whiskey to take those feelings away. And then they go away, and I start again, and I go home, and I'm trying to tell her, and she's on me again, and I got to leave. And, you know, I didn't know until I got to AA. And I talked to you people, and you showed me that that my wife was an individual, and she was a human being. And that I had no right to tell her what to do or how to do it or what to wear or what to say and things. And I learned that from some old-timers here. And they taught me that, that it wasn't my place to direct and manage her life. And, you know, I didn't know that back then. And I didn't know that I was too immature to be a husband, that I didn't have it together enough to be a husband, and I wasn't responsible enough. And, you know, then we had a daughter. And, you know, kids cry and kids make messes. And I don't like people that cry and make messes. I don't care how big they are. I wouldn't want Dan to try and make a mess, for Christ's sakes. You know, Jesus, give me a break. And, you know, that kid would do that, and I'd have to yell and scream at that baby. And then I thought, damn, why do I do that? And the guilt would eat me up, and the anxiety and the shame, and then I'd go drink, and I started that cycle again. And, damn, I just couldn't stop it. I didn't know what the hell the problem was. You know, it was them at home. If they wouldn't talk to me that way, and if she'd keep that house picked up, and if she wouldn't say those things, and if she'd wear those damn clothes, I wouldn't have had to react that way. And I didn't know that I had a problem. I didn't know that I was a problem until I got here. And what happened was, is I got called into the CO's office, and they told me how macho I was. And what they did was, is they issued me a rifle with a telescope on it, and they issued me some live ammunition and sent me across the ocean to a little place called Vietnam. Now, I got to tell you, before I get started on this, Vietnam ain't my problem. It's never been my problem. I am my problem. And when I put alcohol into my body, I become the problem. People, places, and things do not have an effect on Frank Jones. And I didn't know that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So you're not going to hear me point the finger at that country. All that is a two-year part of my story that I'm not very proud of, and I did a lot of bad things. And what happened was, is when I got over there, you see, I was going to be a sniper. You see, I wasn't going to be in the rear with the gear. When I got there and we got off that plane in Da Nang, we was going to take a chopper up north to Dong Han and Khe Sanh and the DMZ. I'm looking at these Marines and I'm terrified. I am frightened because I know what the hell's going on over there. And I can't tell these Marines I'm going into combat with how frightened I am. How do you turn to somebody and say, Jesus Christ, I'm scared, man. I'm an alcoholic and I can't let that happen. I've got to be something. And I've got to impress these guys. And I was too terrified to even move and I couldn't tell anybody. And I got up to Khe Sanh and I found out a secret over there, just like I did in Okinawa. I found out that if I put 151 proof rum in my canteens and I drank that, I became bulletproof and invisible. And it worked for me. And what I could do is all the things I thought I had to do to impress you and to show you I wasn't afraid, because I didn't want you to know about my fear. I didn't want you to know how I felt inside. I didn't want you to know that when I went out and I did all the killing and the burning and I came back in a harbor site with recon, that I was going crazy. I couldn't let you see that, and then I drank to take that pain away, because I wasn't raised to do those things. I had to do it, and then I had to drink to cope with it, because I didn't want you to think I was a wimp. All my life I've wanted to be something that I've never been. And what happened was that during March of 1968, I ended up getting blown up during a siege at Khe Sanh, and I ended up coming home, and while I was over there, my wife and I had a son born to us while I was on Hill 881, and these kids are crying, and she's chipping her teeth at me, and I don't want to hear her crap, and I'm drinking, and I tell her to shut up, or I'm going to kill her, and she don't believe me. And I got these kids crying, and my daughter's 2.5, and my son's about 9 months old, and I'm going crazy, and she's yelling at me, and I'm telling her what she is, and she don't shut up, and I go in the closet, and I get a gun out, and I walk back into the kitchen, and I got to tell you that there was a God in the house that day. You see, and I didn't believe in God, because if there was a God, I was screwed, and I knew that. You see, because I broke off 10 of the commandments where I'd just come from. And I knew if there was a God, I was done for. And I wanted to see a Polaroid picture of this dude. And what happened was, as I walked out of that kitchen, out of that bedroom with a gun, and I had a little girl standing on this leg crying, telling me, don't shoot her mama. And I had a woman running her mouth at me, and I was drinking whiskey out of the bottle, and that safety wouldn't come off that gun. And I jacked around with it, and the spring came out the back, and I pushed that spring in, and the gun went off. And that bullet went into my hand and came out the other side and went down between my legs where those kids were standing. And the bullet didn't hit either one of them. And you see, I'm a blessed man for that today. Those kids are lucky, you see, because I was in a drunken rage, and I could have killed them, because when I drink, I have no regard for your life or anybody else. You see, I don't care about that. And I was just nuts. And I can tell you, standing here sober today, 9.5 years, that if that gun had not malfunctioned and fallen apart, I'd have shot and killed that woman that day. There's no doubt in my mind. I was drunk and I was crazy, and she wouldn't shut up, and I could rationalize and justify why I was doing what I was doing, and it made sense in here. Because, you see, this is where my problem's located. This registers what I should do and shouldn't do until I got a sponsor. And what this tells me is all wrong. And what happened was, shortly after that, she divorced me. Can you believe that? I fired one shot in the damn house. I had a whole clip. I could have shot that place up, and I didn't. And she split with the kids and married a state policeman from Indiana. Can you believe that? And, gee, that just made me crazy. I drank over that for a while. What happened was, I continued to drink and fight, and I became a drill instructor, and I went down on the drill field, and I had to lie, cheat, and steal down there. I wasn't making enough money to subsidize my drinking, and I was starting to urinate a little blood now and vomit some blood, and I was getting sick, and I was suicidal, and I couldn't kill myself, and I was drinking in the bars and crazy, and I had to steal from the recruits to subsidize that drinking. And what happened was, after 2.5 years, I was suicidal, and I didn't have the guts to kill myself, and I was full of shame and self-loathing, and since the only way I could kill myself was I volunteered and went back to Vietnam for a second tour, and this time it became worse. And, you know, I got to tell you some things, that the only reason I bring up Vietnam is a lot of times I speak down south around San Diego and Oceanside and Carlsbad, and there's a lot of military down there. You know, guys come up to me after the meeting and stuff, and they say, you know, I just can't stay sober. I'm having a hard time with this stuff, man. You know, I went over and I did this and that and all this other crap, and I just can't stay sober. I can't get this sobriety thing, you know, and I got to stand there after the meeting. I got to tell them it's just my opinion, you see. There's this thing called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsors made me read this once a year, every year since I got sober. And in this Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, what this book says in here is that if I start going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I start working these 12 steps, and I start using them as a set of tools to rebuild my life, and I start believing in a power greater than myself, and I start taking actions in meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can stay sober no matter what, that if I work these 12 steps in all areas of my life, I can do that. It tells me that I can be happy, joyous, and free. That's what that book tells me. And I got to stand there and tell those guys that there's no place in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no place in that book that tells you that if you've done a lot of bad things to a lot of people, a lot of times, over and over again, men, women, and children, that you can't stay sober. It doesn't say that in there. It says that we can stay sober no matter what. And I got to stand there and tell them that if they're not staying sober, it's because I think they're using that crap as a cop-out, and they don't want to stay sober. And sometimes that makes those guys crazy, and that's just the way that goes. But it's worked for me for 9.5 years, and nobody's done anything any worse or any better than I have. I'm an alcoholic, and I had to do what I had to do to get here. And I can't change the past, for Christ's sakes. If I could go back and undo any of it, I would. I'd undo a lot of it, just like you would. But I can't do it, you see, because all I got is right now. I got right now, and if I put enough right nows together, I'm going to have it tomorrow. But if I don't do it right now, I'm not going to have anything. And I damn sure can't go back into my past. You see, that last tour in Vietnam, I was drinking heavy, and some things had happened. We were going to go across this river and do some things. And I had a radio man that was 18 years old, and he couldn't swim. And he come up to me, and he says, "You're drunk, man." And he said, "I ain't going with you," because he says, "I can't swim." And he says, "You're crazy, and when you're drinking, you can't handle it." And I pointed my shotgun at him and told him, "Get in the boat or I'll kill you myself." And he got in the boat, and we went across that river, and we did what we had to do. And coming back, I was in a blackout. And in that blackout, something happened, and that boat tipped over. And we went into the water, and when I come to out of my blackout, I had a hold of this man. And what I did was I put my feet in his chest, and I kicked off of him. And I swam ashore, and when I looked back, he didn't come back to the surface. And I knew right then that I was responsible for that man dying. I knew I was responsible for him dying. And one of my squad leaders brought me a bottle of whiskey, and by the time I drank half that whiskey, my head told me that that's just the perils of war, and that's his misfortune. And you see, I don't want to ever forget that alcohol does that to me. I don't want to ever forget how I get and how I think when I drink alcohol. I have no regard for your life or my life, and I don't want to forget that. So no one's done anything any worse or any better than I have. I am a drunk that's trying to stay it's anonymous because I can't do it alone. And what I learned in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is if I come in here to you and I work these 12 steps, that I can sleep without waking up having bad dreams. And I can wake up dry. I don't have to wake up all wet. And you know, I've done that for a lot of years. You see, because Alcoholics Anonymous works. See, it just works. I don't know. It's just one of these things that Jim talks about. It just works. And I just do certain things. So that's why I bring up Vietnam. I drank myself out of the Marine Corps after 11 years because they wanted me to come back after lunch, and I couldn't do that. And I had got married again. And I was abusing that wife. And then we had a daughter, and I was abusing her. Not physically, just verbally, and I've gotten very angry and a yeller and a screamer and a fist through the wall and break the window type guy. And I drank myself out of the Marine Corps, and if you're tough and macho the way I am, there's only one thing you can do. After I got out of the Marine Corps, after 11 years, I strapped on a gun and a badge and became a cop. One of Ted's favorite people. And if I'd have met him on the street, I'd have just beat his ass. I just want to tell you that from the jump. I told Claire last night when he was going off on the cops, I said, "I swear to God, I'd have thumped him. I'd have jerked him right out the wind wing." I wouldn't open the door and let old Ted fall out, okay? And I'd have taken his ski pole, and he'd have been a popsicle. I love Ted. And I do. Ted's a fantastic example of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't be that goddamn crazy and get where he's been without working a program. I want you to know that. That's a good man right there, and I've learned a lot from him. And he's a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have a lot of fun. I've been very pleased to get to know him a lot better and Jim today and yesterday. It's been fun. But I became a police officer, and I took out on the street with me fear. And I took out on the street with me afraid of the dark. And I took out on the street with me anxiety. And I took out on the street with me guilt. And I took out on the street with me alcoholism. And I had to abuse everybody because I've got to validate my manhood. I've got to be there because if you get close to me, I'm scared. When I'm fighting, I got to fight you. And I had to fight the people on the street. And I did that. And I'm not proud of that. And I'm not proud of how I treated people. But you see, I had to drink before I went on duty because I can't tell my partner I'm afraid of the dark. I can't tell my partner I'm afraid to go down that alley. You see, that ain't macho. And that's how I was. And, you know, I'm married now, and my wife's pregnant, and I got to, you know, I've always got to validate myself with another woman. I've always got to have something. I had to start having an affair with my partner, for Christ's sake. Now, don't get all excited. My partner's a female. I'm not from Hollywood or San Francisco. And my partner was a female, and she found out I got my wife pregnant. And my partner ended my police career because she shot me. And that's not funny. That's a sad part of my story, John. You're sick. Who's ever John's sponsor? Get down here and counsel him. But what happened? She put a part in my hair, almost blew my damn head off. I look at all the platinum blondes when I come into AA meetings. There's one sitting back there, and there's another one over here. And I look for you, and there's one here that's got the same color hair. Because I may be standing at the podium one day, and that broad will stand up and blow me away from the podium with a gun. And I don't want that to happen. But she shot me, and that because I got my wife pregnant. You women have never given me a break, okay? And all I've ever wanted to do is love you. That's all. And so I entered my police career, and what happened was I did what any self-respecting drunk could do. I got a real estate license. And I started selling real estate, and I got to tell you that if you think money, property, and prestige will fix it for you, if you think if you had a brand new Cadillac in that driveway that you'd be all right, you wouldn't have all this anxiety and the bill collectors after you and stuff. I had two Cadillacs in the driveway, two brand new ones, one for me and one for my wife. We had a house on a quarter acre. I had a three-hole putting green in the backyard, a swimming pool in the back corner, little tiki torches and palm trees around it and stuff, and my kids were wearing designer clothes, and I wore enough gold chains and diamond rings. I had a Mr. T starter kit, and he wasn't even popular yet. I got to tell you, I used to wear these leisure suits, and some of you older guys know about these polyester leisure suits, and I used to wear these silk shirts with the long collars, and I used to have it open, and I ain't got no hair on my chest, and the girls used to comment, and I used to tell them, grass don't grow on a busy street, baby. Just the ego, I love it, and here I am, 42-inch waist in yellow, telling her how cute I am. Oh, it's slick. And I got to tell you that money, property, and prestige didn't fix that stuff. I was making six figures a year, and I was crazy. And I'd nail the windows shut in the house, and I was abusing the family, and I was urinating and crapping blood. And I was sicker than hell, and I didn't know what my problem was. And at the age of 36 years old, I stood there, and I looked around, and everything I'd worked all my life, I just wanted to be like my dad. My dad's a good and decent man, and just a fine example of what a human should be, and he always provided. That's who I wanted to be like. I wanted to be like my father. And I didn't know where in the hell I went wrong or how. And I had these kids and this wife, and it was crazy. And I looked around at the age of 36, and that house on a quarter acre was gone. And that two Cadillacs and the jewelry and the kids and the wife had moved up here to San Jose to a trailer with her parents. And everything I owned was in a cardboard box in the back seat of a stolen car. And if you'd have come up to me and told me my problem was drinking, I'd have told you you're crazy. Drinking didn't have anything to do with that. If I could just get it together a little bit, if I could get one of you lovelies to take care of me, if you just loan me some money, maybe take a second out on your house, you know, to help me. She's the treasure of the meeting. I've got my eyes on her already. And what happened was, if you told me drinking was my problem, I'd have said you're crazy. And what happened was a woman did take me in and took care of me. I ended up drinking in her closet, and I ended up vomiting blood all over her bedroom. And I ended up getting a physical, and I went to the doctor, and when he got through, he called me in his office, and he said, Mr. Jones, he said, I got to tell you, he says, you're 36 years old, and he says, you're an alcoholic, and he says, you're dying. And he says, you got a hole in your throat and dry heaves and cirrhosis of the liver and hepatitis and lung and stomach infection, all the crap that goes along with being a chronic drunk, if you're drunk the way I'm a drunk. And he said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die within 3 or 4 months. And I walked out of his office, and I said, thank you, doctor. You know what I felt when he told me that? I felt relieved. I told him, thanks. I appreciate it. Because, you see, I was tired. I had taken this stuff as far as I could take it, and alcohol wasn't my problem. And when he said alcoholic, I just thought, fine, I'm dying, and I know why now. And I walked out to my stolen car, and I picked the beer up off the floorboard, and I drove to the liquor store, and I bought a case of beer and a fifth of whiskey, and I started drinking as hard and as fast as I could. And I went back to this woman's house, and I got in her closet, and I was piling this stuff down, and I couldn't get drunk. My head was still there, and all the things I'd done to my parents and when I was a kid, and the stealing and nickel and dime stuff, and I was going nuts in Vietnam, and when I was a cop, and I was going crazy, and the drinking wouldn't stop it. And I was suicidal, and I took a gun out, and I was going to kill that woman and her three kids, and I cocked that gun, and I put it in my mouth, and I couldn't pull the trigger. And I didn't know what in the hell my problem was. And I got to tell you how God works in my life, and I didn't believe in God. You see, my father and mother vacation in Florida in a different spot every year because they're old and they're retired, and I hadn't seen my parents or any of my family in 4 years. Last time I seen my brother, I threatened to kill him and burn his house down. And I showed up with an attack dog, can of gas, and a gun. And he gave me some money, and I left. And I hadn't seen him or heard from him in 4 years. And they live in Indiana, but they were in Florida, and they were vacationing, and I picked the phone up, and I dialed the telephone number, and my dad answered. And I told him I was an alcoholic, and I was dying, and to make a long story short, I ended up in a hospital. And I just knew that I felt sick, and I hurt all over, and I went in there, and what they did is they lashed me down to a bed and started pumping me full of vitamin B and magnesium, and they told me I was physically addicted to alcohol the way a heroin addict is to heroin. And they called my wife in California, the doctor did, and said, we think you better fly back to Indiana because we don't think your husband will live through the DTs. And you know what my wife said? You're not going to believe this. She said, let the son of a bitch die. I mean, that's not funny. This is the other sad part of my story. It ain't funny because I didn't die. Jim's not doing this with mirrors, for Christ's sakes. I'm here. I didn't die. I tricked her. I can tell you something else. This year, we'll be married 19 years. And that's not me. That ain't me. That's you folks. That's you folks. You showed me how to be a husband. You showed me how to be a father. So we're going to be married 19 years. Alcoholics Anonymous is that. I can't take any of that credit. I'm a rotten husband and a rotten father till I got with you. But I didn't die, and they unstrapped me from the bed, and they put me in this other part, and I was there for a couple of months, and they cleared up my physical ailments and everything, and then I had to go to AA meetings. And in those meetings they made me go to, I sit in there, and I listened, and I tried to think, and I couldn't track, and I had a speech impediment, and I walked with a limp. But what I kept hearing was, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You have to go to AA if you want to drink. Go to AA if you want to take a drink of alcohol. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I heard that over and over and over. And I thought, 90 meetings, 90 days, if I want a drink, go to AA. And I didn't want to take a drink. I haven't had a desire to take a drink. And I listened to that over and over again. And at the end of a couple more months, I ended up getting out of this other hospital. And I walked out into the sun. And they made me go to 2 meetings of AA in there a day, or they'd have thrown me out. And so I'd been to my 90 meetings. And I didn't want to take a drink, but I stood out in the Indiana sun, and I started crying. And I didn't know why I was crying. And out down the sidewalk come all those little dirty things I had done all my life and started choking me out. And all the things I'd done in Vietnam to those people started choking me out. And then the wives and the two wives and 4 kids and the abuse came down and choked me out. And then the little nickel and dime shameful things that I did that I was ashamed of. And I didn't want to take a drink. I wanted to commit suicide. Now, where does somebody go that wants to commit suicide? You didn't tell me that. You said, go to AA if you want to drink. But I don't know what kind of drunks you folks are. I don't know if you're intense like I was. AA's calmed me down, for Christ's sakes. Hell, I got the 12 steps. I'm serene now. You should have seen me 9.5 years ago. I was wired for sound. But I got to tell you that if you're intense the way I am and you quit drinking and your life starts to go to hell, but you don't, you know, what happened to me might happen to you. I didn't go to AA for 13 months. I got my wife and kids back. We moved into a garage and slept on the floor. We ate out of a styrofoam chest. I was still driving a stolen car. I was still abusing and yelling and screaming at that family. I was still lying, cheating, and stealing and validating myself with other women. And I didn't know why I was going crazy. I wasn't drinking. And at 13 months, I sit there again with that gun wanting to blow my brains out. And I didn't know what my problem was now. I hadn't had a drink in 13 months in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he suggested to me that I read the black part and not the white. He told me that I had to start believing in a higher power. And he told me that somebody hangs that moon out at night and they take it down in the morning. And he said, it's not you. And he said, that's all you have to know, that there's a God and you're not him. And he said that I had to get down on my knees when I prayed. He said, God won't hear you if you're not on your knees. Now, this is the only disease in the world that we can go out and show our ass and sleep in bushes, wet our pants, go to jail and everything else. But if I'm going to get on my knees, don't do it in front of anybody that will see me, for Christ's sakes. I don't want anybody to know I'm trying to help myself or get divine intervention. And what he told me I had to do was go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I had to start sticking my hand out, and I had to start shaking hands. And he told me I had to start changing how I was talking. Because he says, if you talk angry, you're going to be angry. He told me to quit using 4-letter words. He said, that's a sign of a mental cripple. He said, I don't want you to ever stand at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk like that. And he says, what you have to do is you have to start being an example. And he says, you have to quit being angry. He said, where are you from? I said, Illinois. When I got here, I was wearing a Western shirt, a big buckle, cowboy boots, and Levi's. I thought I was a cowboy. My sponsor advised me that I'm from Illinois and I'm no cowboy. And what I had to do is start acting like Frank Jones from Danville, Illinois. And so that's what I've had to start doing. What I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous is I've learned who I am. And what I've had to do, too, besides learning who I am, I have to be satisfied with who I am. And you know, as I work this program, I'm not always satisfied with who I am. You know, I don't like to be a wimp. I don't like to be a wussy. I don't like to be uncool. I don't like to be old, for Christ's sake, and I ain't found a way to stop that process. I want to be an old-timer, and I want to get a lot of time in AA, but I don't want to age doing it. I haven't found out how to do that. We may hear that tomorrow from Jim. He ain't aged a day since last time I seen him. And what happens is what I had to do is I had to learn a lot of things. And I came to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat in the front row like that man told me that day. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, what you folks did is what you did when I walked into here the first time on Friday. When I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you stuck your hand out and said, hey, you're welcome here. Come on in and sit down. Have a cup of coffee. You don't have to hurt yourself anymore. Nobody walked up to me and said, how much money you got in the bank? What kind of car are you driving? What'd you do when you was in Vietnam? What'd you do when you was a cop? You didn't ask me any of those questions. You just accepted me unconditionally for who and what I was. I was an alcoholic that was seeking help. And you stuck your hand out to me and you started loving me. And what you started doing was showing me how to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you did was you told me about the 12 steps, the 12 steps that you heard tonight, last night from Ted. You told me about the first three that I worked by showing up and by getting a sponsor and by getting a commitment and being at the meetings. And you told me about writing a 4-step and putting all my trash down and it's in the past. And you told me that I had to live in the now, and you told me I had to read that to somebody, and I did that. And I didn't feel any great wave of relief when I got through with my 5th step. What I did was let somebody in on my secrets, and I didn't really like that because I figured if you ever turned on me, I could go to jail. And what I had to do is I had to start looking at my character defects and my shortcomings. And I had to pray about those things to some God I didn't believe in. And what I had to do is I had to make that list of amends, and I had to start doing those things. And I had to start paying back fools that I didn't like. I had to start paying back fools that I felt owed me. But you know what? Every time I took a step in Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt better. And that tells me something. That I get back in direct proportion exactly what I put into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous into harmonious living on the outside. And if I don't put anything into those 12 steps, I'm not going to get a damn thing back. And that's just how it works for guys like me. I've got to give it 100% because I give drinking 100%. You see, you can't give it 110%. There's no such thing. I hate to tell folks that. There's only 100%, folks. That's all. 100% of something is all of it, and there ain't no more than all of it. You can only do all of it. And so I just give it 100% most of the time. What happened was when I came into the meetings, I didn't know how to treat my wife. I had filed for divorce. I was angry, hostile, and crazy, and we were living in that garage and eating out of that styrofoam chest. And what I did was, more than what you guys told me, I watched how you treated your wife. You see, I didn't know how to treat a wife when I got here. I didn't know how to be a husband. And what I did was I watched you hold hands with your wife. And I watched you be gentle with them. And I watched you put your arms around them. And I watched how you treated them here in the meeting. You see, I don't go home with you, so I don't care how you are at home. I only see you here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you told me was, is when you go home tonight, try to treat your wife this way. And I said, I don't love her, I don't know her, and I'm not going to do it. My sponsor said, yeah, you are. And what you did was you sick guys on me about Dan's size, and you sick guys on me about Jim's size, and what you did was you showed me how to treat my wife, and you told me to go home and tell her I loved her, and I did that, and I didn't mean it when I told her. Because when I sobered up, I didn't know her. You told me to ask how her day was. And when I asked her how her day was, to stand there and listen. And I heard that from a man in this room tonight. Only when I asked her how her day was, I used to stand there and wiggle my toes in my shoes and think about me. I tricked her. I wasn't interested. But you know what happened by taking those actions long enough? Because what you told me to do was if you take the actions, your thinking will change. And that's what my sponsor told me. So I started doing the action. And you know, I started asking that woman how her day was. And you know, after a period of time, I got home and I said, hey, babe, how's your day? And she started to tell me. And the damnedest thing happened. I started to care how her day was. And I became interested in that woman. And you know what I did? It's the damnedest thing. I fell in love with her all over again. I can't believe it. And she became my friend. And each year I've been sober, we've become closer. And you see, I learned something else here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, we can't have a home and a loving family without God, A, and Al-Anon in our home. And you know, we got that today. You see, my wife goes to meetings of Al-Anon, and she practices her program and all her affairs and at home where it's important. Because, you see, we can practice these principles and steps in the meetings. It's easy. It's easy to love you. It's easy to come in here and be wonderful and do all this hugging and munching and stuff. But it's hard to go home and do it. That's where the heat is. It's hard to go to the job and do it. It's hard to do it out there on those freeways. And that's where I had to learn to do it. But you showed me how. But I got God A and Al-Anon. She goes to those meetings. Now, I got a little more time on my hands than she does, so I kind of help her with her program. I think that's kind of neat. I'm a giver. But we got God A and Al-Anon, and we got a good home. And then, I started loving her, and we're going to be married 19 years because you showed me how to treat her, and I did that. You see, I don't care what you tell me. I don't listen to a lot of it. I listen to how you act, and I watch how you act, and then I go do it that way because I want what you got by your example. Then I got kids at home. And when I got here, my kids were ducking when I walked by. And they didn't like me. And we moved out of that garage into a real home because I had to get a job and become self-supporting. And I watched you with your children at the meetings. I watched you hold them like this gentleman's doing down here with a little boy. And I watched you hug your kids, and I watched your kids look at you and stay close to you. And I thought, how do you do that? And you said, you just reach down and touch them and tell them you love them. They don't know that you don't. And you told me to go home and tell my kids that I love them, and I started to try to do that. You see, my teenage daughter, when I got here, besides my two kids that didn't live with me, I had a daughter that was 3 and a daughter that was 8. And when I got here, my 8-year-old said, Dad, I love you. And I just looked down. I couldn't answer because I hated myself so damn much that I didn't know how that little girl could possibly love me. And I just couldn't answer. And you told me to go home and just touch her and say, I love you. And, you know, I started going home and I started touching those kids and telling them I loved them. And I didn't mean it when I told them. I didn't mean it. I didn't want to be around kids because I didn't know how to be a father. And they scared me. When I got sober, little kids scared me. And you told me, just go and treat them gentle. You told me, don't talk angry at home. You told me to put the soft pedal on at home. You told me to treat them like little people. You told me to treat them like little newcomers. And the way you folks treated me, and you know, I started doing that. And I started telling those kids I loved them. And you want to know what happened? I started to love them. I started to care about how they felt and what was going on in their life. And then my daughters, they've just grown up, and I've just got a good life with those two little kids now. One of them, she's graduating from high school this year, next month. And, you know, when she made cheerleader last year, you know, she came home and she told me, and I cried like a big wussy. I've become the only thing I've never wanted to be in AA. I've become a wimp, for Christ's sakes. And she told me she made cheerleader, and I cried, and I hugged her and stuff, and then she come home this year, and she made captain of the cheerleaders. And damn, I cried again and hugged her. And you know, that little girl that was 3, I got to tell you something. That when I got sober, she was running and ducking from me. And she was full of fear. And she stayed by herself and played. And she was very withdrawn. And she didn't like school or nothing. And I kept doing what you guys told me to do and treating them the way you told me and what my sponsor said to do. And she used to draw pictures of my sponsor in school. And she told me who that was. And I said, good. And she loved him, but she never talked to me. And it took me 3 years sober. And one day I was getting ready to go to a meeting, and that little tyke was getting ready for bed. She ran by my chair, and she looked at me, and she stopped, and she crawled up in my lap. She put her arms around me, and she said, I love you. You can't get that in a bottle. You just can't do it. And that's the first time she'd ever told me, and she was 6-year-old. My daughter was 6 before she ever said she loved me. And you know, you folks have done that. And that's overpaid right there. And that little girl, you know what she did last year? She took golf lessons so she could be with me. And me and her go out and make people crazy behind us. She hits that damn ball around and she hits it all over that course. But you know what? Her and I is together, and that's what counts. Because she wouldn't be around me 6 years ago. And she is today. And that's an attribute to you people, you see. That's Alcoholics Anonymous working in my home because I try to take the program home with me. You see, what I've always wanted to be all my life is macho. What I've always wanted to be all my life is to be a tough guy. I've wanted this. Damn, I got to be tough. I got to stick it out, and I got to be something to impress you. And you know, when I come to AA, you know what you told me and what you taught me? You taught me what macho is. You guys sitting right here have taught me what macho is. Macho is driving a car with a driver's license. Ain't that a hell of a note? I didn't know that. Macho is driving a car with car insurance. I didn't know that. Macho is having it registered to you. Being macho is having a job that pays you a paycheck and they take taxes out of it. Being macho is not having to validate yourself with another woman when you're married. And I haven't had to do that since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of lovely ladies in this convention. And my sponsor tells me I can think anything I want. I just can't act on it. And I think about all of you. But I'm not going to act on it. You see, I love my wife today. My wife's enough, and I'm enough for her. Macho's being responsible and being at the meetings early and talking to the newcomers. Macho's being an example in Alcoholics Anonymous. Macho's staying after the meeting so you ain't so busy to help the newcomers that have problems. Macho is showing up and doing what's asked of you. Macho's being registered to vote. Macho's getting down on your knees with your wife and praying before you go to bed at night if you're married. See, I didn't know all those things until I got here with you, and you taught me these things. Macho's forgetting about the past and living in the now. That's macho. Macho's hugging your daughter and allowing her to see your emotions. Macho's being able to laugh and being able to cry. Macho's being able to be honest. And you know, I'm not macho all the time. You know, I'm still a liar and a cheat and a thief. I can resort back in a minute, and I try not to. And when I lie, I try not to do it as consciously as I always did, and I try to make amends as soon as it happens. And I got to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous isn't just a joyride where we skip through and we do the conventions and we laugh and things, because outside this room, life is going on, and life goes on for me and all of you because bad things happen. Last month, that father that flew to Okinawa, last April I had to fly back and see him, and he had Alzheimer's and a blood clot on the brain. And last month I flew back and I had to bury him. Tough. Tough to do. I love my dad. He was a decent man. And you know what you guys told me to do? I didn't want to go back because I didn't want to cry in front of my parents and everybody back there, because I still got this ego. You know what you told me to do? Suit up, show up, look alert, and support your mom. We don't care how you feel. And you know what I did? Just what you told me to do. I got two brothers, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. They were macho. They laughed and made jokes and stuff. I cried and held my mom. That's what macho guys do, I found out from you tough guys. And so I did that, and it worked. My mom appreciated it. I lost a business in sobriety, a lot of money. We lost everything. I didn't file bankruptcy because that ain't what we do. And you told me not to, so I didn't. And my daughter graduated from Purdue, and she got accepted to Notre Dame Law School, my oldest one. And that's good. And she called me 2 weeks ago and said, I'm going to be a grandpa. And that's kind of decent. I've never had a grandkid, and I'm going to have one, and I'm proud. And the other thing is I just go through life, and I got a son that's in prison, and I had to throw him out when he was 15, and you told me just do it and be an example. And when he gets out of prison, be here for him when he gets here. He's been there 5 years, and he's going to be there some more. He's an alcoholic. I can't change that. You know what I found out? I ain't God. The things I've said to you today don't mean anything to any of you. What they do is they mean something to me. What they do is they tell me what I used to be like. They tell me how very fortunate I am to be an Alcoholics Anonymous and to be alive and healthy. They also, what I've just said, tells me what a good life I have today as a result of this wonderful program, these 12 steps, and my God, that I reinstated here in Alcoholics Anonymous with me through your help. So those things don't mean nothing to you, but they mean something to me. And it's very important to me. I'm glad to be here with all of you. But what you need to remember today, and if you're new or used, you probably didn't even pay any attention to it. But the only thing you need to remember, and you don't even need to think about it, but I try to keep it right in front of me, and that's that first line of chapter 5 that Bob read today, and it says it all for me, baby. It says it all for me. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thanks for having me.